I was profusely sweating, and there's this beautiful lady, mother, probably, I don't know, she may have been in 60s. And she just sat there and she's watching me, continue to wipe the sweat because, when you've been up for 2 days and it's pouring out of you, right? And she looked at me, she says, "Are you all right, young man?" And I looked at her and I go, "I am all right." She said, "Okay, I'm just asking." And I'll never forget her sweet voice. And it was almost like my mom was asking the question through her.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode. On behalf of Disciple of City, I'm Todd Carlton, and this is the Toddcast. Friends, we are currently in the middle of a evangelism initiative called 100K Harvest, where we're looking to see 100,000 Canadians hear the gospel message face-to-face across the country. We are partnering with over 200 churches and organizations in now 26 different cities. And if you're listening to this episode currently, and this initiative started at the end of April, we are currently at 9,172 gospel shares. We've seen 913 salvations across the country so far. Friends, we are also on YouTube. We are on Instagram at the Toddcast underscore DAC. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe and support and get these messages out of these fantastic testimonies. Friends, Disciple of City is also a non-for-profit charitable organization, and if you feel the Lord leading you to help support us and sow into these great initiatives that we're doing, you can do so at our website at discipleofcity.ca. And if this a podcast has encouraged you and you would like to help sow into that as well, you can also do so at discipleofcity.ca. Well, my guest today is originally from Edmonton, Alberta. He spent a decade in the NHL after being drafted by the Washington Capitals. He's played with the Whalers, the Devils, the LA Kings, the Senators, and the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. He's currently the owner of a junior A team here in Ontario called the Aurora Tigers. He's a motivational speaker, and he is running JT Prospects training program. Please welcome Jim Thompson.
Hey Todd, how are you?
Hey bro, how you doing?
I'm wonderful. Looking forward to this.
It's great to meet you, man. Thank you for taking the time today to chat with us.
I've been looking forward to it. Heard lots about you from our friend Tommy and Tommy Lawson, that is. And so yeah, this is a good morning for me.
And quite a hot one. Maybe a better day to be in an arena today. Hey.
Well, it's funny. I'm in my office in the Aurora Community Center, but they've taken the ice out. So it's very, very warm in here right now. I'll get through it. But it's, I think right now, 34 degrees. So as you can imagine, it's a little stifling in here.
Well, here we are locked in with the air conditioner going full blast in the Toddcast studios today. That's for sure. Although I love the heat. We love the heat, right? We
love it. Love it. I don't complain about that.
Yeah, we'll take it, especially after this winter of 14 feet of snow, it seemed like, and forever shoveling.
That 100%.
So, Jim, quite an exciting career in the NHL and hockey and what we love here in Canada. I just really love to start at the beginning. So I see that you were born in Edmonton. Obviously, at some point you came to Ontario. But as you grew up, did you grow up in faith? Was your family Christian? What did that look like for you as a kid?
No, I grew up in a Protestant family. My mom was born in England. My dad was Scottish, born in Markham, Ontario, where I ended up moving, to play junior hockey. I lived with his sister, my Aunt Roma, my Uncle Jimmy. They were Catholic. So no, there was, and I say this, we grew up in a trailer park. I was the youngest of 10, so didn't come from a lot of money. You kind of found your own, excitement. Started working when I was 9 years old, delivering newspapers, because if you wanted money, you had to work. But that being said, going back to your question, I remember going to church with some of my friends. And the highlight of that was, they played the music. So it was all new to me. And then to the kids, we went to the, where the kids hung out and got candy, which was big because, we didn't have a lot of that when I was growing up. And just little things I remember about that. But no, there was no culture of that growing up.
Like as to the way you know it today.
Exactly.
So how old were you when you started? I mean, I guess you obviously started playing hockey. Did you start playing hockey pretty young?
Yeah, I was six. Quick story. A friend of mine, I'd never skated in my life. And we, in the trailer park, there was outdoor frozen ponds. There wasn't even a hockey arena. So this friend of mine said, "You want to come skating today? We're going to clear off a pond." And I'm like, "Okay, I want to come see what this is all about." And he let me use his dad's skates. Now, remember, I'm 6 years old wearing, I believe they're a size 10, if I'm correct. I'll never forget it. The backs were cut off, almost like speed skates. And I packed in socks in the front. And the most amazing thing for me and probably everybody there skating is I'd never skated. And I put these skates on and got on the pond. Couldn't stop. But I was skating from the minute I put the skates on. And I remember my buddies going, "You know, you're lying. You've skated before." And I had never done it. So that's where it all started. Fell in love with it. And, you know, it was the rest of the journey was history as far as the passion and love for hockey.
So you're like, if anyone's seen that reel that's floating around of how a Canadian's born, where they come out of the ice out of a hole with skates on and they just start skating.
You know what, Todd? That's a great commercial. But yeah, it was just so natural, you know. And my father was in hockey. He was one of the top players in Markham. His story or journey was he was going to be protected by the Boston Bruins in the original six. And he went to World War II at 17 years old, fought for 4 years, and was a sergeant, was honored by, got a citation from General Montgomery, which I have, which I'm very proud of. And he came back, and obviously hockey was over for him, and he became a professional chef up in the oil rigs in Alberta. So the hockey bloodlines were there, unbeknownst to me, obviously, that I hardly saw my dad growing up because working in the oil camps, he'd be gone for 2 weeks and only home for 2.5 days my whole upbringing, right? So didn't really get a lot of time with them.
2 weeks up there and 2.5 days home and then back again. That's right.
Then back again. So I'll never forget it. He'd arrive about 4 o'clock on Friday. And again, that was exciting. Pull up to the trailer, and being a chef in the oil rigs, he'd come home with a bag of goodies, you know, chocolate bars and Macintosh apples, which were like gold back then. And then he would leave Sunday about 2 o'clock. And he'd be gone again for 2 weeks. So, you know, I say this, you know, obviously he had his job to do for his family. But, you know, if he took me to six hockey games my whole career, I'd probably say that was a lot. And not that he didn't want to. He just wasn't around. So I had depended on. And my mom never had a driver's license. She had 10 kids, was from England. And so I thank goodness I was good because I had parents always taking me to hockey and coaches who wanted me on their team. So I never struggled to get picked up for hockey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So now I know, like, when kids grow up and they're playing hockey as little kids and they're watching the NHL, everybody sort of has that dream, you know, as kids to be in the NHL one day. At what point for you did that sort of become a targeted reality? Like, this is actually something you can achieve, if that makes sense.
Well, I was shooting pucks in my driveway at the trailer park. I was Anders Hedberg. He was my favorite player, a Swedish player that played for Winnipeg Jets back in the WHA. And he ended up being on the New York Rangers. And I was shooting on Ken Dryden. So the empty net and minus 30 weather, I just shoot pucks all night till I had to go in and get ready for school. And you dream then, right? Because that's when the Rangers played Montreal in the Stanley Cup final. So that was my dream, that I was in the final playing this movie in my head. So the reality of my life, at 12, you know, I was making money. I was starting to timekeep at the arena, the men's league. So I was doing pretty good financially, and being from a addiction based family, if you will, my parents were both alcoholics. I started drinking baby duck champagne and smoking marijuana when I was 12 years old. Wow. So that, when you talk about the dream was there, you know, from 6 years old up till 12. And then the dream became foggy because all of a sudden, you know, partying and girls and There wasn't a lot of parenting. I always say this, my parents were the best parents. They knew how to be under the circumstances. By the time I came along, there wasn't a lot of parenting. Obviously, my dad wasn't in the scene. My mom was pretty worn out by the time I came along. And so I did my own intervention at 14 because I was a good hockey player and told my mom I wanted to quit high school. And I would, stop hanging around with the group I was hanging around with. And my brother Frank was there, and she said, "No way, I'm not having another kid," because all my older brothers quit school. And he said, "You better let him do it, or else he's going to do it anyway." So what happened is she let me do it. I took correspondence, Todd, which was a home-based schooling. My brother set up a makeshift gym in my living room in the trailer. Used the coffee table as my bench press, and you made do. And I walked over to a rink called Parkland Arena every day to play pickup from 10 till 12 with the adults. And they're all wondering, why is this young kid here? I was 14 years old at this point. So that was my intervention of getting out of this lifestyle, because hockey at the end of the day was my passion and my life, which it turned out to be. And that was a unique moment in my life. So that all came together. And then I was 15, turning 16, when I moved to Markham with my 25-year sobriety uncle, who really helped me out. He went through a bad life of alcoholism, so he is, he had the foundation for me to stay grounded, if you will. And my aunt was a lovely, lovely lady, and they took me in for 3 years and played for the Markham Waxers of the OJHL, and then I went to the Toronto Marlboros of the OHL, which was cool because playing in Maple Leaf Gardens, and then I got drafted by Washington. And then, obviously, the career goes from there. But my foundation as a child, like my the people I grew up with, some friends, some acquaintance, they till this day say, "How did you do it?" Because they knew how out of control I was at those crucial years of childhood, right? And I always say this, respect to trailer people who lived in the trailer park, because I lived, my whole childhood there. So I have a lot of respect for it. Every time I go back to Edmonton, I do my 15K walk in the trailer park and reminisce about memories. But when you watch the Trailer Park Boys, the movie, the show, it's not far from that. It's a lot of alcohol, a lot of that lifestyle, and call it what it is. It's low rent living. We had no money, and that's you scrape by to feed a trailer full of kids.
Yeah. Was there any sort of Christian influence to you up until, so you brought us up to when you got drafted to the Capitals. Was there, obviously you had some good people because they were helping you with hockey and stuff. Was there any kind of influence, or did that come
No.
later?
I'll tell you when it first happened. So playing in Washington, Mike Gartner was, strong Christian. Him and I are talked today. I actually saw him not long ago at a restaurant with his family. And he would give personal Bibles out at Christmas to all the players. Not knowing anything about Christianity or, taking much interest in it, I never thought much of it. I don't have that Bible. I wish I had that Bible today, like, because it was so nice. He had our names on it, and Mike Gartner is a Hall of Famer and just a wonderful, wonderful man, family man, just a great guy. So that was my first kind of look at, wow, okay, this was different. And then as my career went along, playing in Ottawa with Laurie Boschman and a couple other guys who are, in strong into Christianity, I started to, pay attention a little more. So then, where I first really, really got introduced to it was when I met my wife now, Rita. Her name is Rita. Strong Christian-based family. And, that was where I stopped swearing. That was where, culture changed, and just little things that, she never said a word about my swearing. Not that I was a big swear, Todd, but, she just one day said, "I would prefer you don't use the F word." And that's when that seed was planted, where, yeah, unclassy, where's the class and all that. So that's kind of, and started going to church and following my own journey here that has changed my life.
So a couple interesting things there. Well, first of all, same thing with me with, you know, growing up in Catholicism or whatever, some parents that were part of that, you know. But same, I met my wife who came from a strong Christian background. And so there's some similarities there. And friends listening, watching, just to preface, you know, it's not, especially if you're listening from a different country, and maybe it's the same in your country, but nothing wrong with Catholicism, Anglican, if that's what you said, or Protestant, I can't remember which one, but.
Well, and let me stop you. I got to tell you this story before I forget. So I'm now living with my aunt and uncle who are strong Catholics. Okay.
Yeah.
My aunt had a prayer meeting every Tuesday. She had all the ladies over from the church. So I come home from school on a Tuesday and all these women are sitting down in the living room and she's introducing me. It's the first time I've ever met them. And one of the ladies said, "So what religion are you?" And out of my mouth, I go, "I'm a pedestrian." Right. And my aunt goes, no, Protestant. I said, "Oh yeah, Protestant." Right. So we tell that story till this day. My cousin was there, but you know, that's how educated I was in religion at that point. But yeah, certainly, like you said, things changed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just wanted to say that, you know, there is passionate believers in both of those denominations. Right. And it's just that for a lot of us as Canadians, for you, perhaps, and definitely for me, it's that it was more of a, more than an actual connection for some of us. It's like cultural, you know, like for us, you're belonging to a denomination just because it seems like it's just part of your culture, but it hasn't actually come real to you yet. But all that to say is that in those denominations, there are definitely passionate believers, like your, you know, weekly prayer meetings and stuff like that. We've heard a lot about Mike Gardner too on this show. I've heard a lot about him for, this is our fourth season, and I've heard about him from the beginning. We've actually had Lori Boschman on this show. So it's funny.
Wonderful man.
Great guy. So as you get introduced to all these things, you know, with Mike and Lori and stuff, and your wife, did you have a moment where something sort of shifted, where things maybe that you believed in, where things sort of became more real to you?
Yeah, I do. We were at church and they had this play. They did a play and not funny, but they wanted me to play Jesus in the play with my long hair and my beard. And I was a little bit, I should have done it, but I was a little bit gun shy and they had somebody else play Jesus in the play. After I watched, I'm like, damn, why didn't you take on that role? Right.
It's a big role. There's a lot of pressure.
Well, it was a beautiful, you know, hour performance that they put on. So at the end of the performance, they basically opened up the front to say, if anybody, you know, has, you know, a feeling or something that you want to, that came out of you after this performance, come on up to the front. And it was, you know, just, I walked up to the front, not even realizing I was walking up to the front, left my family in the aisle. And I just went up there and, you know, as you know, had hands put on me and we talked and it was just a moment of that kind of, you know, not out of control, just like, okay, this is where I need to be. And I'll never forget that moment. What blew my wife away was, wow. Because I'm staying away from, you know, the deep actions of Christianity. I'm just a very private, laid back guy, not embarrassed of anything. I look at every human being as God's children, no matter what religion, what color. I'm an equal, you know, everybody's equal. Some have different beliefs. But that was a moment of, I'm going, okay, you got me, meaning in a positive way, like I get this now, right? So that was a powerful afternoon for me.
Yeah. And where were you in your career at that point? Who were you playing for?
Oh, I was retired.
Oh, you're retired.
Yeah, I met my new wife long after retirement. My first wife, you know, again, her family wasn't religious based. They were an English Scottish family also. So there was no church or praying in our, you know, my first 17 years. We had three beautiful children. And then meeting Rita, obviously praying at dinner and anytime we have a meal, and I normally say the prayer and enjoy that. Bless this food to our bodies and the hands are prepared, buddy, right?
Amen.
Amen.
So going through your career, how was that like? you had guys like Mike Gartner, you had guys like Laurie Boschman, but also you're playing professional hockey. And so there's, not that I played professional hockey, but I could just imagine, right? You've reached that ultimate goal. So you're making some decent cash and getting lots of attention. And was there a struggle for you there, or how did those, say, the pull from fame and whatever lifestyle that looks like without the Lord to guys like Laurie Boschman and the influence that those guys would have had on you as well, or the encouragement?
Well, I'm glad. What a great question, because you just brought a memory back to me. So I'm a rookie in Washington, and our captain, Rod Langway, right? He loved Howard Stern, and Rod was in the dress room at first every morning. He was on the bike, two-time Norris Trophy winner, and he'd have the Howard Stern show on. And we all know what comes out of that. You know, there's, it's not conducive for, for Mike and his beliefs. So Mike would come in and he would turn it off and he'd put it on music. So there was this, that's the first time I sensed this, you know, inner battle of just a rate, like, what are we listening to in our world? Right. And it's funny afterwards, you know, later in life, I was skating at Mike Owens Hockey Arenas here with Wes Jarvis, who's also a great fella. And I said to Mike about that situation and I thanked him. You know, I said, I wish I would have paid attention more. And he says, it's not about time. There's always a time. He goes, look at you now, right? It took time, but there's always a time. But I said, that was a time where I was going, you know, good and bad, because again, you know, Howard Stern is a very, very successful, wealthy talk show host that, you know, talks about a lot of things that Christian people wouldn't want to listen to. Right. So,
well, at times I remember, if you're the same time frame when he first came out and got really big, he talked about things that a lot of people didn't want to listen to, pushing the envelope.
100% freedom of speech. But yeah, that's where the first, you know, radio on, radio off thing. And that became kind of this division in the dressing room, you know, Bible thumpers to rock and roll party life. Right. And it was this little bit of division. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, dude, we've made a connection just before we jumped on the show with music, similar music tastes and stuff. I came to faith later in life. And so music greatly influenced me. And I went down a path of that genre of music pretty deep before I came to know the Lord. Did you have a similar experience in that?
Well,
that you're willing to share?
Well, 100%, right? Because my favorite group of all time is U2, which is a Christian-based band. So here I am, all from the 80s. New Year's Day was the first song that I fell in love with them back in, I think, 81. And been to many of their shows. You know, when you ask the question, if you could sit with somebody on a bench, anybody, past or present, for 1 hour, mine is Bono. Because what he's done in the world, what he's done with his faith, what he's done, like, he's more of a giver than a taker, right? So what's funny when you say that, and then when I found out, wow, my favorite group's a Christian-based group, was a powerful thing for me, right? Because then you go back and listen to the music, and you're like, wow, does that bang me in the head, right? Yeah. So that was my music head-on collision, that ironically my favorite group of all time were Good Guys.
Yeah. And so I guess then in your career, because you need to be dialed, healthy and stuff like that, you're pretty solid throughout your career in the show.
What do you mean solid?
Like, you know how I was just saying, did, you know, with the music, did the music and any kind of like a party lifestyle sort of drag you in that way in your career, or were you just dialed because you have to be so fit?
Oh, good question. No. So growing up, and I had an addiction in me, as I, you heard, at 12 years old. So when I was a very serious hockey player, okay, I took my training serious. I was bang on with everything I needed to do to be prepared, because let's face it, I was, you know, in the NHL, I was a fourth liner, fight, and I had 147 pro fights, and not that I liked one of them, but that's what I did. And in the American League, not I could score. I was on 50 goal paces some years. So I grew up a scorer turned into my brothers were tough guys. They were bikers and hit first, ask questions later. And, I learned all these protective instincts, go never sit in the middle of a room. Always sit with your back to the wall. See what's in front of you. Never know what's going to happen. So drives my kids crazy, right? As soon as we go into the restaurant, that's dad's seat, right? And sometimes with the girls, it's the couch, right? So anyway, so I lost myself there. What was the question again?
Just that what you didn't you weren't steered down the wrong path because you were so dialed into your
Okay, sorry, I got you now. Okay, I'm
yeah.
back. So having the addiction bug in me, right? Parents, alcoholics, so on and so on, introduced to drugs. Then what happens is I always had that party bug. So serious athlete, but guess what? We got a night off. I would go hard, right? No question. I would drink till I blacked out, get up, be a mess, catch the bus. Back then you could handle it more. I've been sober for 18 years, so I haven't had that issue. But yeah, so I was very serious, but I had when we could let loose, I let loose 100%.
Yeah, and I guess when you're young, you can kind of do that for a while, but it'll take a toll on your body, eh?
Yeah, it takes a toll. It takes a toll. And when people say, "Would you change anything?" And Todd, I say this, how I help people today is from my own life experiences, right? So when I do an intervention or do go into a family crisis and help that family or help somebody who's suicidal, I was three times this close to taking my own life. And it's my experience that helps them, not the book, not school, not, nothing. It's what I lived, which is my story, right? And so, the blessing today is would I have changed anything? Yeah, I wish I wouldn't have partied as hard as I did when I partied, right? Like waking up, not remembering what you did last night, that's pretty dangerous, How did I get home? Looking out the front door, praying that your car's not there, that you drove home. Pretty reckless lifestyle, but that's the life of addiction, right?
So you helping people in intervention, yeah, can you talk about that a little bit? How
Oh, love it, love it. So, in the book of sobriety, 2 years of sobriety, you can start helping people. So I just celebrated my 18th year of sobriety. I'm in my 19th. And right away, because of, me, I love to help people. I love to, I don't like to see sad situations. So any way I can make a situation better, that's what I have in me. So I started helping families. I started and then word of mouth, can you come? And then it, spiraled into, hundreds of interventions. I've driven more people to rehab, intervention, getting my truck. Same thing I did. My ex-wife put me in an intervention, saved my life. And I went up to a place called Newgate 180 in Merrickville, Ottawa. A lot of NHL players go there. Great place, saved my life. And so, yeah, I now will, it's a very rewarding experience, sad to see, especially mothers crumble that their 14-year-old daughters got into crystal meth or, their superstar athlete is, smoking crack. And, I always say this, I dealt with a family sad that, scholar girl, 14 years old, went to a party and had two coolers and got buzzed. And she thought she was going to smoke marijuana and it was crack cocaine. And basically the addicted right away and living in a crack house, and we got her out of there and she's back into the real world now. This was years ago, but those situations, whew, are those rewarding. And you don't save everybody, we know, not you, but I know in addiction, until you're ready to surrender, you can go to rehab 100 times. I've taken the same one person, I've taken 6 times, and the parents have spent upwards of $200,000. When you're not ready to surrender, forget it.
Yeah.
And I surrendered on my son's birthday 18 years ago. I was flying back from Edmonton and been on a 2 day crazy, crazy ride. And I didn't know it was that time because every time you go on 2 days, smoking crack, and my drug of choice was crack cocaine and OxyContin, and should have killed me many, many times, without, we won't talk about all the booze I poured down me, but I just flew home that day and there was this peaceful aura. And I got home and threw everything out and went through an awful detox. But I said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And my first tattoo in rehab, I don't know if you can see it, is if nothing changes, nothing changes. When I went into my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, that's the first sign I seen when you talk about spirituality. And it was like, getting my whole body was just like, wow. Does that make all the sense in the world? So November 17th, back, 18 years ago, was my day of freedom, and it's been good since.
Praise God.
Oh yeah.
Praise
Oh
God.
yeah. Oh yeah, I do. I do.
And that's nasty what you said. Just we're just back from, well, I'm just back actually from Newfoundland. I went there to connect. Well, I was talking about the 100K harvest at the beginning, and I just went there to connect with a local city leader there and went out with somebody from his church, and we went down to a hotel for the homeless, and I had a great chat with a guy who was, I think he was 64, and it's crack and just the brokenness, right? Of this guy lost everything, lost everything to it, lost his family, lost all his money, lost his house, wife, everything. And just really the depth of brokenness, and really thankful for people like yourself who are, willing to help and minister to these people. Because there's a big thing in society of compassion burnout, where you see it, and a lot of people, you get groups of people, they don't know what to do. You got people that are burned out and think, well, you just, you're never gonna. But there is a lot of truth to the fact of you have to want to be free, right? You have to.
I've been doing this, like I said, and until somebody's ready to surrender, that's what Theo Fleury, who played a long time in the NHL, I don't know if you've ever read his book, and he uses that phrase in there, I surrendered. Finally, I surrendered. And that's the truth of it. That flight home from, Edmonton back to Toronto, not even knowing, because when you're in addiction, you don't know when, do you know how many times after, like I said, going to bed, completely out of it, going, that's it, I can't do this anymore, I'm done, I'm done, I'm done. 2 days later, you're using again, right? So you never know when that magical moment's going to come, or in this gentleman's, life, does it ever come? And I lost two brothers to, cancer through smoking and drinking their whole lives. It's, my sisters are in their 70s. All three brothers lived hard, and they all died in their 60s, right? Science is science. You're going to live hard, probably going to shorten your life. And, that's another thing that I, preach, if you want to call it that, in my hockey team, I don't allow chew, I don't allow vaping, none of this stuff. And I traded a player that was very good because he wouldn't stop vaping. I said, it's going to kill you. Sorry. Well, my parents allow me to do it and it's legal. Beautiful. You're not doing it here. So I'm, because again, my foundation growing up with it, I've watched it all. And I lost both of my parents to smoking and drinking, my two brothers. One got killed in a car crash because he was going to get more beer at 3 o'clock in the morning. Back in Alberta, you can go to off sales in a bar. So they took off from the cottage and, no seatbelt, and the truck rolled over top of him. That was his life, right? But all based around this lifestyle. And I always say this, as parents always said, nothing good happens after midnight. And, a lot of our tragedy in our families is to do with drugs and alcohol. And that's just the truth of it. That's the science of it, right? So that was, and I don't want to make this government based, but being a addicted, I was addicted to marijuana. I needed it. Like I was a bear without it. So I was smoking, like just I needed it. And when, I saw the government legalize it, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is going to destroy our youth. These kids are on gummies and all the stuff that's out there available. It's I'm not getting into the politics of our world, but being a former addict, I'm anti-drugs and anti-alcohol. I've watched more people ruin their families and lives, in drunken stupor states that they wish they could return. They just take that night back, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not laughing because it's not funny,
Yeah. No, I'm with
but
you too. I.
it's a disturbing thing for me to see, and I don't want to be around it. Sorry. I don't want to, I tell my wife, I don't want to be the guy that's, the what do you, the goody goody, whatever you want to call it. But because of my past and how I watch it destroy, going to a function and watching, people my age out of control because they're under the influence, I'm just not about it. And I don't want to judge. I'm not judging because that was me. And when I look at back at some of the dumb stuff I did, Todd, it makes my skin crawl, right?
Yeah.
And just that's all alcohol and drug based. Sorry.
Yeah.
But
And
I know I don't want to get into that too much, but that's my foundation now. I'm anti.
you know what? Hey, I'm on the same page with you because I came out of that too. And at the time, it seems like it's fine and it's in control, but it's not, right? And it's just like and same thing with you, not judging, whatever, to each their own, but you see it suck you down a rabbit hole. You know what? I quote or what it was for me. And you'd know this, but Guns N' Roses, Mr. Brownstone, and that lyric in that song of "I used to do a little, but a little wouldn't do it, and a little got more and more."
Yeah.
Right? And it just like that's just the truth, right? It sort of, but.
Listen, there's a saying, one is too many and 100's not enough. And that was me. The minute I tasted it, true story, I'd be sitting in a place up here, Shoeless Joe's, right? And I knew that after my third big schooner beer, if I ordered my third, meaning if I've had two, by the time I told the waitress I'll have three, I was speed dialing my dealer. Right? That's how my life, that's how programmed the addiction was. And then that could go on for 2 days, right? We don't sleep on those drugs and destroy, destroy, destroy.
Yeah. So, Jim, can I ask you on the plane, going back to that plane ride
Yeah.
for you, because you had mentioned, you want to, you go to bed and it's like, oh, I'm never doing this anymore. And then you wake up and.
Well, you don't go to bed, you lay in bed sweating and in a serious depression because you don't sleep when you're on those drugs, right? You eventually fall asleep, and that's normally when the birds are singing and the sun's out. There's that story, the birds sound great, or you'd want to, you know what I'm saying. So
Yeah.
yeah, but anyway.
But just having those feelings of I'm not doing this again, but we do, right? Or addicts do. If you take yourself back to that airplane ride, what was different for you? What was going through your mind, your body at that made that moment different?
I was profusely sweating, and there's this beautiful lady, mother, probably, I don't know, she may have been in 60s, and she just sat there and she's watching me, like continue to wipe the sweat because, when you're been up for 2 days and it's pouring out of you, right? And she looked at me, she says, "Are you all right, young man?" And I looked at her and I go, "I am all right." She said, "Okay, I'm just asking." And I'll never forget her sweet voice. And it was almost like my mom was asking the question through her. I kind of, when I reminisce about that, because it wasn't like she was trying to get away from me or screw me. She knew I was struggling. And I got off the plane, got home, and just I was walking around real calmly, real, real calmly. I'll never forget it. I was just like, can't do this anymore. And when I dumped, this was a big one. Because when you're on OxyContin, I had 12 surgeries, Todd. I had some serious pain go through my body during my days, broken back, shattered heel, some real tough, tough broken pieces that were painful. I'd never experienced the pain of detoxing from OxyContin. And anybody who's done it and did it cold turkey knows what I'm talking about. My bones were crumbling inside my body. It was 7 days of torture. For the first, week, I couldn't walk. I crawled to the bathroom. No, true story. Couldn't get on my feet. And that was the toughest part. right? Was cleaning all that garbage out of your system. But that was a day of, it was a time of reckoning. And, I just, when I watch, and people go through that, and I'm going, oh my gosh, like if you watch, the Dope Sick with Michael Keaton. I don't know if you've seen that show, but I recommend everybody watching it because it'll give you the story of OxyContin and, that awful drug that killed over 500,000 people. Should have taken my life. But yeah, to answer your question, it was just a calm, painful peace. And one day led into another day, led into another day, and here I am 18 years later.
Praise God. Praise God for
Yeah,
that.
oh, 100%, 100%.
And praise God for a woman on the plane that sees somebody and is not, turned away or pulled away from you, but has the compassion of the Lord to say something to you and just show care, right?
Her voice was just making sure I was all right, and just the way, again, are you okay, young man? Just the way she said it kind of just jolted me, right? No, I'm not okay. I'm actually dying here for the next 5 hours, right? So a plane trip I'll never ever forget because it was painful. It was, I was in a jail cell for 5 hours that I couldn't move, and that's what it felt like. And I'm like, I can't do this anymore. But how many times had I been there? And people in addiction know this. And all of a sudden, 2 days later, I'm back at Shoeless Joe's or somewhere else having a couple of beers going, oh, gotta make a call. I
Yeah.
never made a call after that. God willing. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe she was an angel, bro. Who
She
knows?
could have been. She could have been. I remember. I still remember her face.
Wild.
Yeah.
So you've been helping people with recovery and stuff, which is awesome. Owning this team, talk about owning this team, because if you're owning a junior A team, then you're also, I mean, sure, it's a business or whatever, you're obviously investing into these young people too. So how did that start for you, and where's your heart in that?
So, purchased the team 11 years ago. My wife and I both had a boy that played. They played in Ottawa, Canada, and it wasn't a good experience. And a friend of mine owned the team and called me up and said, "Hey, I'm selling the team. Would you be interested in buying it?" And originally, it was for a better foundation for our kids to play. And then, obviously, our kids left, and here I am 11 years later. So, I meet with families, and in junior A hockey, Todd, it's like this. You spend a lot of money and buy in the best players to win a championship. I tried it twice, spent a lot of money, got to a conference final. After the second time, my wife said to me, "Is it worth it?" And I'm like, "No, because you don't make money in junior hockey." So what our philosophy is in Aurora is develop, mentor, and get them scholarships. Our goal is to make the playoffs. And if you get into the playoffs, then you want to go deep. Then with goaltending, hockey terms, you never know. But our goal is here not to win a championship. I know that freaks a lot of people out because winning is everything. Winning to me is a good culture, a good foundation for people entrusting me with their kids. Zero drinking, zero drugs, zero chewing, zero vaping, all these nasty habits that I won't allow. And at the end of the day, we want to get their kids what they sign up for and invest in scholarships to get off with school. And I say to every player that plays for the Aurora Tigers, if you can get a scholarship and play 4 more years of hockey and come out with a degree, that is your NHL. If you go on and make the NHL, that's gravy. If you play pro hockey in Europe, it's gravy. Playing university hockey and getting those 4 years and coming out with a certificate, that is what my NHL is. That is, and it's developing these young men into good people, right? And that's my, when you mentioned JT Prospects, it's a mentoring training company that I've been running now. This is my 27th year. And that's all based on culture. I'm not going to bore you with it all, but I don't like swearing. If I go down to the room and I hear F, I'm like, guys, no swearing. Like, there's no need to swear. You want to, it's like this in business. Sit down at a business table. As soon as F-bombs start flying, you've lost me because I don't think you're serious. Sorry. People may disagree with that. I think it's a non-productive word. And Not because I'm a Christian. It's just because how you bang your thumb with the hammer and say the F word. Okay. But to sit there and have a bunch of, 17 and 18-year-olds swearing, that whole culture's not for me. So again, Roar Taggers, it's all about culture and getting these kids on to the next level with some foundation.
Well, actually, that's really interesting that you say that. I like that because we're in a culture that's pulling people the other way, right? Because you see in minor hockey, not to, and again, not judging, but I may have had a kid that was in minor hockey where that kind of language is going around in the dressing room, and they're kids. They're not even like at the age that you're talking about, right? They're kids, and to a lot of people, I don't know, I appreciate, anyways, having a culture, having a place where kids can go and see that, you know what, that doesn't have to be that way. There's more to it, and having the focus, it shows that you care, actually.
Well, I had this conversation. We just played in a big tournament this weekend called the TEP. And a guy was talking to me about the unraveling of minor hockey. And I said, let me ask you a question. I got three kids. This is how I judge the event I took my kids to, whether it was dancing, soccer, whatever. They get back in the car and they talk about how great of experience they have, how they love their coach, how they can't wait to go back. I'm in the right spot. Or they get in the car. I can't have, he's using the F word. He's swearing at me. He's telling me I'm no good. I don't want to go back. Those are your two options. So, we're trying to make our world better. We're trying to make, these volunteer coaches. I admire them, all of them, in every walk of life. But where do we get off using these words with 10-year to 11-year-old kids? Because what, we're trying to win a trophy and get to the NHL ourselves? Some of these coaches think they're going to be the next, Paul Maurice. No, you got 15 impressionable young people there that your responsibility on behalf of the parents is to give them a good foundation of happiness. So when I go to a game and I start hearing coaches F-bombing at that age level, I walk out of the rink. I went to watch a kid's a friend of mine's kid play, and I was used the word disgusted with the behavior and the craziness, what was going on with 11-year-old kids. And I said to my buddy, I said, shame on you. He goes, what do you mean that you're allowing your kid to be in that environment? I said, shame on you. I'm out of here. It's not for me. Ironically, that head coach was fired 2 weeks later. But what took me to go watch one game for somebody to say something? Come on, everybody. Kids want a good foundation. They want to be happy. They want to go and enjoy it, not be abused and bullied and told how awful they are. They're kids. Even at our level, junior hockey, they're young adults trying to figure it all out. I got mental health coaches that I employ on my hockey team. Because these kids are under such duress and such stress that I'm just getting a call here. I got to hang it up. Sorry. That I have them talk to them, and it's confidential. School and girlfriends and parents and what else? What else? You know what I'm saying? And so I have these people work for my hockey team because I know when you talk about mentoring and all this stuff, how much people need to talk. Bell Let's Talk is a brilliant thing.
Yeah, a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
A lot of pressure.
I had a call come through. Did it beep on your end? I
No.
apologize if it did. Oh, beautiful.
That's okay. Yeah,
Okay.
we're all good.
Good.
Jim, you want to plug your JT prospects? Like, if there's people listen, we have people listening, praise God, all over the world, which is awesome. But for people that are more local that are hearing this and that might want to look into that JT prospects, it's a
Well,
website.
I appreciate that. I would rather, my website tells my life story, which to me is more valuable. And that's Jim Thompson's Dreams, no P in Thompson. If they wanted to follow me on Instagram, it's a picture of Ovechkin and I sitting together. It's Jim Thompson 33. That is my Twitter and Instagram. And that would be, information on my JT prospects and what I do. But yeah, back my website, some good. And what's on the website I love is because back when I played with the Kings is when all the movie stars would come around. So if you go to the The pictures, the gallery on my website, you'll see Tom Hanks, John Candy, Sylvester Stallone, Kurt Russell, all these longtime movie stars that used to come down to our dressing room. What, two of my favorite were Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan came to all our games. It was really cool. So, and obviously the Secret Service that followed him in, which, we're sitting there going, wow, this is wild. But yeah, some neat things I saw in LA. But yeah, my website would be fun to check out.
And you get to play with the great one.
I did. A quick story. Grew up in Edmonton and I was a free agent out of New Jersey. So I had four teams that wanted to sign me. Detroit was the best fit for my style because they needed some toughness. So I agreed to a contract with Detroit. And my agent called me the next morning and said, LA just matched the contract, but we're not going to go there because they got, McSorley, Jay Miller, a lot of physical players. He said, you'll end up in the minors. And I said, his name was Steve Bartlett, Sports Consulting Group. I'll give him a shameless plug. Great, great man. Helped my career, helped me after hockey. I said, no, Steve. I said, I want to play with my idol, Wayne Gretzky. And he's like, it's a bad decision. I said, I'll figure it out. Sure enough, and just started in the minors. Fought my way up to play with my idol Wayne Gretzky. And at that time, Yeri Curry, Marty McSorley, Charlie Huddy, Mike Kuchinski, Paul Coffey, all the Oilers, were around the LA Kings, right? So, yeah, that was a special time. But that was a dream. There was a great dream. Wow, I can play with Wayne Gretzky. Growing up in Edmonton, watching him play, my oh my.
Yeah, Canadian dream right there.
Yeah.
That's so good. Jim, thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with us. Really appreciate that. Great to hear your story and your journey throughout your career and especially now what you're doing today, influencing people and just being a positive influence in hockey for all these kids and helping people get scholarships. That's really great. Final question for you, my friend. You talked about an individual who was vaping, was doing something, and you were very adamant about, hey, you know, it's not going to happen here, and in that situation, they're looking at, well, it's legal, and these people say it's okay, but you don't. If someone like that or in that situation, somebody came to you, or that person came to you and really wanted to know more of your heart about why you're being so adamant about that, and then you saw an opportunity like Mike Gardner had with you and Lori Boschman and stuff, what would you say to them?
So this was my, I'm a three strike guy. I never give up on a person, but I feel after three minor interventions of the risks, the rewards, he promised me he would quit. I opened up the door, looked outside, and he's in his car, and the puffs of smoke are coming out, right? And that's when I said to him, if he would have came in to help, I would obviously would have helped him, Todd, till. That's what I do. But he was bigger than the help. And when he brought his parents into it and said, they allow me to do it, I'm saying, okay, I can't win this one. So I can't have you here influencing my other 23 players because those parents are depending on me to keep this garbage away.
Yeah.
Right. So back to your question, I'm here to help anybody if they want the help. Right. But if it's a, I call it smoke and mirrors just to appease, the program and the culture. No, not. It's just I sniff it out because, again, my lifestyle. I can pretty much figure out. Quick story before we go. One of my players, how are you doing? They all walk in right by my office, and then all of a sudden, the player was hiding under his hat. I'm like, that's different. So I did my due diligence to find out that he had some issues off ice, and we got him help. But it was just a change quickly in demeanor. That I realized, he may have an issue, and the most beautiful thing is he comes back now as a man and thanks me for taking the interest in his addiction and helping him in his life.
That's awesome, man. Again, Jim, thank you for sharing and thanks for your genuine compassion for people like that individual that came in, that you saw that and that you reached out to them and helped them.
Thank you, Todd, because you did more for me today than I did for you, and I'm gonna have a wonderful day today. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Bless you.
Bless you too.
friends, can we do that? Can we recognize the person that has their hat down, that are dealing with something? Can we be that firm? I really appreciate Jim's firmness and his stance on these things of wanting to see people successful and at the same time not judging, but just being firm to bring people to where they need to be. Special thanks today to Tom Lawson for making this connection with Jim and myself. Thanks to executive producer Caden Carlton, Toddcast Media Relations, Sheila Jitti. Friends, be blessed, and we'll see you next time.